From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
For those who think AI in education is a terrible thing, it seems that battle is already over.
It's really important that we recognize that AI is here and we can't hide from it.
Also this week, a school district in the Florida Panhandle is racking up big legal fees to defend book removals.
As these laws came into place, school districts really interpreted them in dramatically varying ways.
We'll also check out the Florida impact of the federal government shutdown and discover that seaweed has more uses than you ever imagined. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and the end-of-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. Artificial intelligence in Florida classrooms is shaping up to be a hot-button issue at the state capitol. Tristan Wood reports state senators recently heard presentations from experts and district superintendents about how AI can be, and is already being, used in schools.
Maya Israel is a University of Florida professor in educational technology and computer science education. She says AI could impact K-12 schools in several ways, including streamlining administrative tasks and helping provide specific lesson plans for students. She also says how to use AI and what its limitations are should be a part of what kids are learning.
In the K-12 space, what we're trying to do is make sure that kids have the preparation and the interest in these tech-mediated fields so that when they go into higher education or into whatever they're doing post-secondary, they have the skills to be able to do this work, or at least the skills to know that they can.
However, Israel says she recognizes there are significant concerns, including what happens to student data. She says school districts have been focusing on integrating closed systems that won't feed student information to a larger database.
So the AI is not like the ChatGPT that's on your phone. All of the data stays in the school districts, and there's control over that data and who owns it, and is it being used for just student learning versus being out there for others to use.
Hillsborough County Superintendent Van Ayers says more than 600 students are enrolled in educational courses about AI in his district. He also hopes to encourage more teachers to get certified in AI education.
Really, the central belief here is around that human-centric belief that this is not a replacement to human interactions. This is going to enhance our work and make us better.
Outside of the Capitol, top educator labor groups agree artificial intelligence is not an enemy to Florida teachers.
It's really important that we recognize that AI is here and we can't hide from it.
Florida Education Association President Andrew Spahr says while the technology is here to stay, it's important that it's implemented carefully to ensure the best outcomes for students.
So the question becomes, what are the guardrails that we put in place to make sure that AI is enhancing the learning for students and not being used as a shortcut around learning. So we have worked with our national unions who have been working with various AI companies, OpenAI, Microsoft, et cetera, in really talking about the guardrails that need to be in place to ensure that AI is actually helping students and not doing the work for them.
Ultimately, Spahr doesn't view AI as a replacement for human teachers because he says students need hands-on personal instruction.
AI technology is a tool in the toolbox. It does not replace the actual one-on-one instruction. And keep in mind, you know, we've already seen technology used in the classroom. We saw it during COVID when people were learning at home, and we saw significant learning loss. So we know that being in person, having that one-on-one conversation between the teacher and the students and other students within the class, being able to interact is extremely important in the development of young people.
The conversation comes as legislative leadership and Governor Ron DeSantis are recognizing the importance of understanding AI's potential. are recognizing the importance of understanding how AI could impact Florida's workforce and future. I'm Tristan Wood.
While we're talking about classroom stuff, the Escambia County School Board has spent nearly $1 million on legal fees to keep certain books out of school libraries. The district has paid attorneys big bucks as they respond to federal litigation. Gina Jordan sat down with WUSF's Douglas Soule to discuss his reporting on the story.
Some school districts have removed notebooks, and others have removed hundreds. Escambia is one of those school districts that has removed hundreds. The school district and its board got two federal lawsuits filed against it. One of the lawsuits is about a single book. The authors of And Tango Makes Three filed suit. Now, And Tango Makes Three can be purchased for less than $8, yet the school district has spent more than $300,000 keeping it off its shelf. The person who filed the challenge had some concerns about LGBTQ plus content. That book is about two male penguins raising a chick together. It's actually based on a true story out of a New York zoo.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting that literally these two penguins named Roy and Silo at the Central Park Zoo in New York, this is what it was based on.
Yeah, and I'm sure most people have heard of this tale, so it's not a sexually explicit one at all. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, some of the books removed do have some very adult content. This is not one of those books, and one person challenged it, school board agreed, and now we have federal litigation that could be precedent setting, but regardless, has cost the school district hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, okay, so what does Florida law say when it comes to the ability to request that books be removed from school libraries?
So it's interesting because there have been recent laws that have greatly, greatly increased the book removals in this state. These laws have accompanied the rise of conservative parental groups like Moms for Liberty. But the laws that have been passed, they haven't necessarily created the right to challenge books. You could have already done that, but it formalized and expanded the process and also just publicized the process. And as these laws came into place, school districts really interpreted them in dramatically varying ways. This is evident because some school districts have removed no books, and some school districts have removed hundreds and hundreds of books. A lot of times, what we're seeing is these school districts are maybe confused by the law, definitely scared by the law, and don't want to run into legal woe. So they're preemptively removing all these titles. They don't want to get in trouble, essentially.
Yeah. So what I'm wondering is, let's say you've got parents who have the right to say, this book is inappropriate. I'm challenging this book. What happens? Who decides whether it's pulled, how long it's pulled?
That's actually a very interesting question. One of the laws that was passed required there to be a creative process in place. In the case of And Tango Makes Three, a district review committee actually okayed the title to remain on shelves. Now, the school board in Escambia has the final say, and that's seen really across the state. And they decided, no, we disagree with this review committee. We're going to remove it off the shelves. Each school district has a different process in place. A lot of acclaimed classics have been removed. The Handmaid's Tale was pulled off the shelves. Slaughterhouse-Five was also pulled. I mean, these are books that I remember in high school were typically assigned in the classroom to read.
Yeah. I'm wondering if the districts are kind of between like a rock and a hard place, because there is this state law that says these parents can challenge the books. And if the districts don't fight to then keep those off the shelves, then we have more litigation, or they could get in trouble by the state. What do you think as far as what options districts really have?
Well, book access advocates will 100% maintain that a lot of these books simply shouldn't be removed off of the shelves, regardless of the challenge policies in place. In recent months, the state has actually really ramped up its focus on the content on school shelves. The Department of Education has even called a superintendent before its education board to explain why certain books aren't on the shelves. That's something that we hadn't seen in the past. When this all really started, a lot of times what we saw were state government officials explaining that this was up to the school districts. Now we have the state government outright saying, hey, school district, remove this list of books. So the pressure is definitely on these school districts. They don't want to run afoul of the law. They don't want to run afoul of the state government. But there is litigation at play, and I think they're knowledgeable that if they make a decision some disagree with, they could face that. That being said, there's a lot of book removals across the state, not just in Florida, though. I mean, those two cases could set nationwide precedent. So the whole nation is watching Florida's westernmost panhandle county in this litigation.
Yeah. In your reporting, you mentioned that the Nassau County School District opted to return the removed books back to shelves rather than face a similar lawsuit. But might there be another lawsuit by parents? I guess this is where I'm just kind of wondering. There's so much pressure coming from the state on these districts. You know, is it really that simple? We'll just put the books back and that's the end of it.
Well, Nassau, when it faced litigation for its book removal practices, it quickly agreed to put the books back on the shelves. It really shows that there is a certain level of priorities at play in Escambia, especially in regard to Antigo Makes 3. Had they returned the book on the shelves, they likely wouldn't have had to spend $300,000+ on litigation. I actually talked to the Florida Education Association president, Andrew Spar, this week, and he viewed that appropriation of money for legal fees to be what he called a waste of money. He said that could have been used to support students, that could have been used for teacher and staff pay.
Yeah, so Escambia is dealing with budget pressures like I think most Florida school districts are dealing with that kind of pressure. And I think any of us would go, how can they afford this litigation?
You make an interesting point. Very recently, the school board of Escambia voted to raise the property tax due to budgetary pressures they were facing. And let me also pivot here, because we're talking about the money, but we only talked about one facet of where that money is going, which is the Antigo Makes 3 case. There's a separate federal lawsuit where this school board has distributed nearly $600,000 in, and that's a lawsuit that was filed by National Free Speech Organization PEN America, huge book publisher Penguin Random House, and others. That one's not focused on an individual book removal, but a whole host of them, and that one is also ongoing. The Antigo Makes 3 case, the judge in that case actually ruled in favor of the school board. The authors are quickly appealing. The PEN America case is ongoing. Both of these cases represent more money the school board's going to have to spend, though. I also got some data showing that the school districts of Volusia and Orange counties have spent tens of thousands on litigation costs. One thing I also want to point out is that the state government itself has been involved in a lot of cases related to book banning and First Amendment law. These are also very potentially precedent-setting cases. So there's a lot to continue to follow here.
That was WUSF's Douglas Soule speaking with Gina Jordan. Coming up on Capitol Report, as the federal government shutdown drags on, we'll hear how it's affecting those government workers and the many clients they serve.
How would you run the administration without us if there's no one to answer those phones?
And if you think seaweed is just the sushi equivalent of parsley, you're in for a surprise.
Seaweed can be used for a variety of different things, and consumption is actually just a small fraction of that.
Hundreds of thousands of federal workers are feeling the effects of the government shutdown on their household budgets. Employees are working for less or no pay, while the White House threatens mass layoffs. Tierra Carter answers the phones for the Social Security Administration in Tampa. She's also with AFGE, a federal employee union. Carter spoke with WUSF's Gabriella Paul about how the shutdown is affecting her family.
I have been reaching out to other resources in my community to try to get some help. I've even applied for a loan with my local credit union for assistance, and I've also been managing off of credit cards.
What exactly is your status in terms of how much you're working and how much you're being paid?
I am considered an essential accepted employee. I'm only under furlough if I can't make it to work or if I have an approved absence from my employer.
How has that impacted what your paychecks look like?
Actually, tomorrow is our last payday, and it's going to be a partial payment. For Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday of next week, we are not getting paid.
I know it's pretty confusing from the outside. I don't know if it feels confusing on the inside. Like, are you getting clear instructions on what to expect?
So on October 1st, it was pretty clear as to what was to be expected of us. But as the shutdown continues, rules have changed. When the shutdown started, it was told to us that all we needed to do is request furlough. If we had an emergency, if we had a doctor's appointment, if we had pre-scheduled leave, but now we need to bring doctor notes. We have to show proof as to why we're not coming to work. I've had a couple employees reach out to me and they've been advised that they're being AWOL because they have no way of showing documentation that they're in a financial hardship and they have no means of making it to work.
And what does that mean to be AWOL?
It's basically an absence without pay, but it also puts you in jeopardy of discipline down the line. You can even lose your position.
I know one thing that's setting this government shutdown apart is that on top of furloughs, there's also been threats from the White House that there could be sweeping layoffs of workers. How does that influence the culture at work?
It definitely makes our anxiety at an all-time high. We're stressing about the fight that's going on in the White House. We're also stressing out about how we're going to handle our financial situations at home. We have to make sure that there's still food on the table. But at the same time, we're worried that, hey, if I can't make it today, am I going to be penalized for trying to feed my family?
What does it feel like to work for the government, but also quite literally be impacted by the government as well?
To be completely honest, I feel ashamed to be an American citizen right now. I mean, who does this to their own essential workers? How would you run the administration without us? If there's no one to answer those phones, if there's no one there to fix payments and make sure that over half of America receives their benefits each month.
What kind of services can you guys offer right now when somebody calls in?
We can tell them about their benefit, but we just can't send them a verification of it.
On that point, what does a shutdown do for operations and service disruptions?
It's heartbreaking and absolutely heart-wrenching to sit up there and explain to American citizen that I cannot give you proof of a benefit that you've been getting for years that you need in order to live a normal life for yourself. And I'm actually feeling exactly what that caller is going through. I'm the person that's sitting there trying to move this over here, move that over there to try to make ends meet.
I know you serve the whole American public, but what do you want your neighbors in Tampa to understand about the work you guys do and how it's impacted when the government is shut down?
Please empathize with us right now. From the anxiety of home to the anxiety of what we're going to face going to work the next day or having to call off, we just need compassion from our callers and understand that we're trying.
That was Tierra Carter, a federal employee in Tampa, talking with WUSF's Gabriella Paul about navigating the ongoing government shutdown. Florida is taking steps to remove vaccine mandates. Health experts are concerned the move could lead to lower vaccination rates and a rise in preventable diseases, such as polio. WUSF's Megan Bowman reports that one disease most doctors in the U.S. don't even know how to recognize or treat is polio.
Dr. Jennifer Caputo-Seidler is a hospital physician in the Tampa Bay area. She says when she heard the state is lifting vaccine mandates, she started to see a lot of messages from doctors asking how to treat polio.
Today, the people who are training to be pediatricians, they're not taught how to recognize a case of acute polio when it comes in. And the doctors practicing today have never managed it.
Including herself.
I didn't learn anything about polio as a medical student other than the fact that it's part of the childhood vaccine schedule.
And while some specialties like neurology may learn about the disease, it's frustrating for people who have experienced polio, like Kenneth Fuller. He was born in 1955 in Cocoa, Florida. He's a father, minister, musician, and polio survivor. He says the lack of knowledge among doctors makes him feel unseen and unheard.
We go to doctors who are like, what's polio? You know, what's polio syndrome? We don't know how to treat it here.
For nearly 3 decades, he's lived with post-polio syndrome, something that happens to people who contracted the virus as children. Fuller had vaccine-derived poliovirus.
I was 6 months old when I was given the live vaccine that contributed to my being in the hospital from ages 3 to 12 and enduring 7 orthopedic surgeries.
He didn't use mobility aids until around 1990. He was standing at the pulpit and his legs gave out.
So every morning I wake up with pain. I can take care of myself, but sitting up for longer periods of time, taking care of my yard, going to the mall, those are things that I am limited in doing now.
Fuller uses a scooter to get around. If he goes out for 2 hours, he's in bed for the next 24. The Pennsylvania Immunization Coalition estimates about 300,000 polio survivors live in the U.S. Up to half of them may experience some degree of post-polio syndrome, like Fuller. University of South Florida infectious disease expert Dr. Michael Tang says it's a really dramatic disease.
Because a lot of times for kids, it's lower limb paralysis. And so they end up in a wheelchair or in braces. There's also a little bit more severe is when you have infection of your lungs, muscles that cause contraction of your lungs to allow for breathing.
In 1979, polio was eradicated from the U.S. thanks to inactivated vaccines and has been eliminated in most, but not all, other countries.
Nowadays, it's 4 doses of the inactivated polio vaccine. Because there really isn't transmission here, so we're not so worried about interrupting transmission cycles.
But Tang says most modern cases of polio come from other countries where wild polio is still around, like remote places in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Doctors there use an inactive vaccine along with the live one. So global travel could bring the virus back to the U.S. That may be what happened in 2022 when an unvaccinated resident of Rockland County, New York, was diagnosed with vaccine-derived polio that was transmitted to him from someone who'd gotten a type of live vaccine that hasn't been given in the U.S. since 2000.
We don't see polio really here, and the polio that we do see that's coming in from imported cases or people who have traveled.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says if vaccination rates drop, poliovirus could spread. Kenneth Fuller continues to advocate for others who have experiences like his. Despite debilitating fatigue, depression, and pain, he's an advocate for today's inactive polio vaccine.
If they roll back this vaccine, it's going to be devastating for not only America, but I think for other countries. I mean, I understand Darwinism. I understand the survival of the fittest. But damn it, we can do something about this.
For now, the state health department has removed requirements for several vaccines. But those for measles and polio will remain mandatory unless legislators vote to update the law. I'm Megan Bowman in Tampa.
You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, seaweed is one of the most versatile types of vegetation. The ability to be more than just a sushi wrapper is the reason seaweed aquaculture has become part of a billion-dollar business worldwide. The harvesting of seaweed has been dominated by Asia, with China accounting for well over half of the world's seaweed production. So, as the citrus industry continues to falter in Florida, could seaweed be a viable option to become part of Florida's agriculture industry? WGCU's Sandra Victorova discussed that with Ashley Smith, an associate professor of soil, water, and ecosystem science at the University of Florida.
A lot of the work that comes out on seaweed has come from not tropical systems like we have here in Florida. So our work is focused right now on finding out if we're able to culture and grow a seaweed that is marketable and could be profitable.
What are you finding right now? I know you're sort of early in the process, but what are you seeing so far?
Yeah, we are just getting started. And so right now what we're doing is we are actually working with our commercial shellfish farmers, because seaweed right now for them is treated as a nuisance. Like, It covers their clams, for example. And so they have to go out and spend extra time to remove all that seaweed. And so that seaweed, though, has a lot of potential. It could be really tasty treats. It could be really great at nitrogen storage and actually like have water quality benefits and be used as fertilizer. So right now what we're doing is going to these leases and just characterizing the types of seaweed that we see there. This is our way of saying this seaweed does grow here in Florida. And if it's growing here, it's native, it's natural, then there's a chance to cultivate that. Once we have identified the most common species of seaweed that occur on our shellfish leases, we're then taking it back to the lab and we're going to do some genetics and try to figure out if any of the seaweeds that we have do have really high potential for different commercial operations.
How big is the potential market for seaweed? I think when people think of seaweed, they're probably thinking of, you know, how they might, you know, eat it in sushi. But there's a lot more purposes for it, right?
Yeah, seaweed can be used for a variety of different things. And consumption is actually just a small fraction of that. Seaweeds in cosmetics, seaweeds can be used for pharmaceutical production, and seaweed can actually even be used in packaging material to reduce our reliance on plastics.
I think a lot of people are wondering, since you mentioned nitrogen, what is the impact to the health of our waters and the environment by bringing and farming it to our waters?
So aquaculture is farming in the water, and it is a green industry. It actually does a lot of really great things for our waterways. So we can think of, let's use shellfish for our example here. And shellfish are really great filter feeders. So what they do is they actually clean the water and they can remove nitrogen in doing that. And they provide tasty treats for us. So it's really a win-win-win. Aquaculture often gets a dirty reputation, mm-hmm. like they think of it as a bad thing. But a lot of that actually comes from what we know from other places where it's finfish aquaculture, and it's these big pens where they have to use feed or different medicine to treat the fish. Mm-hmm. But we don't have that with our shellfish aquaculture. And seaweed would be the same thing. In fact, seaweed aquaculture would provide a benefit for our waters because it sucks up that nitrogen that would otherwise cause those algal blooms and have our waters turn that guacamole-colored green that no one wants.
Right, right. Well, I'm not familiar with how you farm seaweed. So share with our audience how actually would these farms, you know, produce the seaweed? What is it? What does that process look like?
This is a great question, and one of the things that we're trying to work out here in Florida, there's a variety of different ways that you can culture seaweed. Some people will actually put it on ropes, and so it's big, long lines that hang throughout the water, and there's just seaweed attached to that. Some other organizations will put seaweed into different cages, and those cages sit in the water, and then they get tumbled and moved around, and the seaweed just grow in there. And then we also grow seaweed on land. So we have these land-based systems or tanks where we can bring in water from the ocean and help to get the seaweed to grow in a more controlled environment.
That was UF Associate Professor Ashley Smith speaking with WGCU's Sandra Victorola. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Douglas Soll, Gabriella Paul, Megan Bowman, and Sandra Victorova. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Evan Rossi, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us again next week online and on air for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.